Chapter 5. Bang shields, clap flagons, and sing songs of war. Her tempo increased, her movements becoming sharper and less fluid, but her strikes more deadly. Dumwil couldn't figure out exactly what the sword was trying to do. The sentient weapon was guiding her, telepathically prodding her, thrust, riposte, feint, parry. Step back, she heard in her thoughts. She had not moved quickly enough for Kazideya's liking. Then she sensed the great regret of the sword, as if they had failed. Before she could inquire, though, the sword was prodding her once more, the same routine, but now slowly again, and adding in the step, over and over, building muscle memory. Dumwil still did not question. She came to believe that this sentient weapon was preparing her for a fight with Tiago. Or more to the point, she admitted to herself, she desperately wanted to believe that was Kazideya's plan. The Bayenri fiend had taken her again the night before, in the forest by the road now beyond the Silver Marches. The violation all the more wretched because she knew it was not wrought out of any honest emotions he held for her. That would be bad enough. But simply to remind her that he could take her whenever he wanted, for whatever reason he wanted. She would love to feel her sword violating his body. A jolt shocked Dumwil, startling her and jerking her upright, the weapon lowering as all strength seemed drawn from her arm. You think in pedestrian terms, the sword scolded. Dumwil took a deep breath and tried to steady herself. Would you like to kill him? Yes. Do you think that would hurt him? I wouldn't make it hurt. She could feel the sword's amusement, silent laughter mocking her. Tiago Bayenri does not fear death, the sword explained. But there is something else that he does fear. Dumwil spurned the obvious question, and instead she considered all that she was doing here and Kazideya's grand plan. Humiliation, she said aloud, and she felt the sword's agreement. And she felt the call to get back to her work. Kazideya guided her again, thrust and parry, sharp and fast. She moved ahead, but only briefly, then quick stepped back, holding balance, sword going out left low and right high in rapid succession. Though she was alone on the field, she could feel the parries as surely as if her weapon had actually struck steel. Left and right. And that clue, left and right, showed her the truth of this exercise. She understood clearly then that her sword wasn't preparing her for any fight with Tiago, who fought with one sword. Kazideya was training her to battle a two-handed opponent, Drizzt Do'Urden. And Kazideya knew that drow ranger well, and knew Drizzt's companion Catti Bree even more intimately. She had wielded the sword, which she called Cutter, for a short time long ago. And Cutter had dominated her. A question formed in Doomwheel's mind, but she blurted it, not wanting to give the sword the satisfaction of reading it from her thoughts. Why not return to Catti Bree? She asked. You can control her and easily strike Drizzt down. She felt the sword's seething response. Dumwil dared a little laugh at her pompous weapon's expense. She is a chosen of Mialiki now, she taunted. She has progressed, grown stronger. Too strong for you are the same. You know this. Are you enjoying this? The sword asked. Do you believe that you too will grow beyond me? Do you believe that I will let you? Dumwil swallowed hard. That was as direct a threat as Kazideya had ever given her. Do you believe that you can grow beyond me, that you can succeed without me? The sword went on. Will you seek your friends, your mother perhaps? Not your father, surely, for he is a rotting corpse. To go along with the telepathic words, Kazideya imparted an image of Tosin lying in the bloody snow, under the glaze of dragon's breath. At first, Dumwil thought it her own memory, and in a way it surely was. But then her father began to rot, skin sliding away, maggots writhing. Wicked Kazideya had taken her memory and had perverted it. One day, Dumwil reacted to Kazideya's questions before she could think the better of it. Cassidea quieted her thoughts, and she felt as if the sword was leaving her alone then to reason her way through it all. She truly did not believe that she could survive now without executing the plan, and she could not hope to do that without Cassidea. Perhaps the sword was subtly within her thoughts, but Doomwheel didn't believe so. She came to see her relationship with the powerful, sentient weapon in a different light then, not as a matter of dominance and servitude, but each serving as a tool to help the other attain its desires. Doomwheel brought the sword up in front of her eyes, marveling at its workmanship and the sheer beauty of the fine-edged blade. The large, flared crosspiece had been worked intricately and beautifully, set with a red gem in the center like a wary eye. Doomwheel's own eyes widened as the pommel became a unicorn's head, then turned dark, the shape of a panther, Guinevere! Oh, was it transforming? Was it really? Or was it making her see those images? But it remained a panther. She ran her trembling hands over it and could feel the contours exactly as she saw them. Her father had told her that when he had found the blade in a rocky valley, its pommel had been exactly this, a replica of Guinevere's feline face. She had thought it an exaggeration, but indeed, the resemblance was striking. Before her eyes, under the touch of her fingers, the pommel changed again in shape and hue and became white. Sunrise, Doomwheel breathed and swayed, for now the sword's pommel looked like a Pegasus, snowy white save a hint of peak in her flowing manes, with feathery wings tucked in tight and head bowed as if in sleep. Doomwheel had loved that creature dearly. When Sunrise had grown too old to take flight, Doomwheel had tended her. And when Sunrise had died, peacefully a dozen years before, young Doomwheel had cried for many days. "She is with Sunset now," her mother had told her, referring to Sunrise's mate, who had been slain in the war with Obuld, shot from the sky by the orcs. A twinge of anger shot through Doomwheel. How could she have ever sided with the ugly orcs in the war? The thought flew from her mind. She was too taken with the image to realize that Cassidea had forced it away, and she focused again on the image of the pommel. "As if in death," Doomwheel whispered. "Peaceful sleep," Cassidea quietly whispered in her mind. She felt contented as she continued to stare at the beautiful pommel. And truly no elf craftsman could have made a better likeness of the beloved Pegasus. It was as if the image of Sunrise in her mind had itself formed the artwork now in front of her. "As if," she said with a self-deprecating snicker. She realized then that that was exactly what had happened. Cassidea had found that precious memory and had seen it as clearly as Doomwheel could. And now Cassidea replicated the beautiful Pegasus on its malleable pommel. On the pommel of Doomwheel's sword. Her sword. Her partner. She gave a little laugh as she considered her relationship with Tiago, who thought himself her lover, her master even. But no, her intimacy with Cassidea was a far greater thing and one of mutual consent. She knew that now. The sword would lead her to that which she desired. The sword would keep her alive. The sword would bring her to great glory. "Will you grow beyond me?" Cassidea asked. "I cannot," she said. And the words were from Doomwheel's own heart then. "I will grow with you, and you with me. I will not dominate you, little doe," the sword promised. Doomwheel slowly shook her head. "Nor I you," she thought, and she believed. She stroked the Pegasus sculpture lovingly. "You know my heart." Soon after, they went back to their practice, and Doomwheel's movements came more easily and fluidly, and she fought better than she ever had before. Cassidea was pleased. Even by dwarf standards, the squat stone buildings tickling the skyline above the tall gray wall of the city of Mirabar could not be considered beautiful. They spoke of utility and efficiency, and that was no small bonus to the dwarf mindset. But even Brunner, glancing upon them again from afar, from the field beyond Mirabar's closed gates, could not begin to feel the lift of his heart he might know when standing outside the cross walls and angled towers of Citadel Adbar. Even the city of Silvery Moon, so reminiscent of elves, could stir a dwarf's heart more than this block of boredom. But that was Mirabar, where the Marchion and the great lords hoarded wealth in personal coffers instead of financing any gaudy displays of aesthetic pleasure. Mirabar was the richest city north of Waterdeep, famously thick in the spoils of vast mining operations. The Overcity, what they saw now peeking above the wall, was but a fraction of the Marchion's holdings, with a vast array of subterranean housing and mining operations.
"Bah! But we should know of come here!"
Emerus said to Brunner as they looked across the fields to the place, and could see already that the guards of Mirabar had grown animated, running all about.
"Are our brothers in there not Delzoon, then?" Brunner asked calmly. "Mirabar in first, I'm thinking, and few friends in there a clan Battlehammer and Mithril Hull," said Emerus.
And Brunner knew it was true enough. The Marchion and his city had not been thrilled when the mines of Mithril Hall had reopened, nor had they been the best of hosts when King Brunner had passed through this place on his return to Mithril Hall with the news of King Gandalug's death more than a century before in 1370 DR. Brunner sighed as he thought of the good friends he had made there, though, of Torgar Delzoon Hammerstriker and Shingles McRuff, who had led 400 Mirabaran dwarves to the cause of Mithril Hall in the first war with King Obuld. And the Mirabaran survivors of that war had stayed and pledged fealty to Clan Battlehammer. Many of their descendants, none of whom had ever returned to Mirabar, were on the road now with Brunner. He thought of Shudra Stargleam, the human woman, Septrana of Mirabar in those long-ago days, who had come to Mithril Hall to fight Obuld, who had given her life for the cause. He thought of Nanfoodle the gnome, and he could not hide his smile as the memories of his dear little friend flooded his thoughts. He remembered Nanfoodle blowing up the entire ridge north of Keeper's Dale, launching frost giants and their war machines into the air in a blast that would have shown a bit of humility to Elminster himself. Nanfoodle had gone on the road with Brunner in his search for Gontalgrim, and had served the dwarf as friend and ally throughout decades of dangerous searching. Many tears had slipped down the cheeks of Brunner Battlehammer when he had knelt before the grave of Nanfoodle the gnome. Nanfoodle of Mirabar.
"All them dwarfs of Mirabar who put their Delzoon blood afore Mirabar came to your side in the Obuld War," Emerus said. "Them that stayed here stayed in fealty to the Marchion of Mirabar. That was 100 years ago. Aye, and so you're more removed from them than e'er," said Emerus. "Mirabar's ne'er but a friend to the citadels of the Silver Marches. She's held her love of trade with the Sword Coast above any loyalty to fellow dwarfs." "Bah, they were just knowing that our weapons and armor were better than they could be making," said Brunner. "And our mithril bars more pure. If them lords of Waterdeep got a gander of Adbar mail or Felbar swords, or the purest mithril that give me own hall her name, then Mirabar'd become no more than a trading post where east would be meeting west." "Aye, me friend," Emerus said, and he clapped Brunner on the shoulder. His smile didn't last, though, and he quickly became more somber. "They've not changed their song about ye," he said. "We might still be turning aside, telling them that our road's to the north in Icewind Dale." "The dwarfs of Mirabar are Delzoon," Brunner said. "They got a right to know. They got a right to come along and fight for our home, for the throne of the dwarf gods and the ancient forge that burns with the power of a primordial beast of fire. A fine Delzoon leader I'm being if I walk aside this place without leaving the truth." His mounting speech fell off when he noted the approach of Drizzt, Catti Bree, Ragged Dane, and Conorad Braunhanvil. "If you're telling the dwarfs of Mirabar, you're telling the Marchion and all the rest," Emerus reminded. "Them humans in Mirabar ain't much for liking Mithril Hall or yourself, even if they're not believing ye're who ye say ye be. They owe ye no loyalty, and so ye should be expecting none. I ain't. And where are ye thinking the news'll go?
Amorous said. Right to the Sword Coast, Drizzt interjected.
Aye, said Amorous, to Waterdeep and to Neverwinter, and no doubt them dark elves in Gauntlegrim have got spies all about, and agents in Neverwinter. And so if ye go into Mirabar and tell the dwarfs the truth of our march, then you're likely telling them drow that we're coming for 'em. Aye, and so be it, said Brunner.
And he strode forward to step up a low bluff and better view the distant city.
We got 4,000 Delzoon dwarfs standing behind us. Them drow will know we're coming long afore we're crossing the underground lake to Gauntlegrim's top door. And so be it. Once we got the top floor and the throne, we'll chase them into the Underdark.
It is one drow house, Drizzt said to Emerus. Powerful with magic, but not numerous.
How many?
They will have slaves to fight for them, goblins, and...
How many drow? Emerus pressed. Not much worried for goblins and the like.
I have not been to Menzo Berenzon in more than a century, but from what I knew, perhaps 200 drow in House Zorlarn, perhaps 300. Many are wizards, though, and no minor practitioners of the art.
Couple hundred?
Emerus mulled, and he looked to Ragged Dane and chuckled.
Go to Mirabar, Brunner, he said. Come on, then, I'll be right aside ye.
He waved to the others to follow, but Drizzt stepped back.
Mirabar will not have him, Catti Bria explained. Well, they would not when last he passed this way.
Bob, in 100 years, said Brunner.
But Drizzt was shaking his head, for it had not been 100 years since he had last futilely approached Mirabar's imposing and closed gates. But it didn't matter anyway. He wasn't about to put his pride and stubbornness ahead of the good of the expedition. Better that I remain here, he said. Perhaps I'll scout ahead along the western road while you finish your business. Brunner and Drizzt shared a long look of complete understanding, both ways, the dwarf nodding his agreement, the drow responding in kind.
I'll go with you, Catti Bria said.
But Drizzt shook his head. Brunner will need you. The woman agreed with a sigh. She missed Wulfgar and Regis then, they all did. She didn't like having to leave Drizzt alone with the harsh reality of the prejudiced world lifting its dark wings once more. And she couldn't argue the truth of his statement that Brunner would need her.
If the Marchion of Mirabar speak in one ill word of ye, or of me husband, she said in her best dwarvish accent, then I'm turning him into a frog and squashing him flat on the floor, don't ye doubt.
She stormed ahead to the southwest, toward the distant city, and all the others were smiling widely as they trotted to catch up. Drizzt was smiling too, so glad to have this woman in his life. He grasped the unicorn pendant on the chain around his neck, thinking to call in Andahar, but paused as the rest of the entourage hustled to catch up to the principals. Athrogate and Ambergris trotted side by side and very close to each other, often bumping and always laughing, and Drizzt was glad for that. The sisters Fellhammer, Fist and Fury, seemed in a bit of a race to see who could get to Brunner's side first. They had been doing that a lot along this march, Drizzt had noted, and he wondered then if his old friend would perhaps find something in this life that had somehow eluded him for most of his last existence. When the ranger looked at Catti Bria and considered his own good fortune, he hoped that to be the case. Though from a long distance, Drizzt was visible to the two. However, even with the sun far behind them, lowering in the west, and even with some overcast dulling its brilliance, Tiago had to squint hard. He wasn't enjoying the world above as much now that Sabrak's darkening was no more. He and Doomwheel crouched atop a hillock and looked back to the east at the vast dwarf army. And now they saw the unicorn thundering past the ranks as the dwarves set up their encampment, riding out to the southeast toward the road.
He goes to scout, Tiago said, grinning with every word. Perhaps it is time to claim my prize. He went up to his hands and knees and began to crawl back from the lip of the hillock, taking great caution, even though it would have been next to impossible for any of the enemy force to spot him among the trees at such a distance. Doomwheel noted that caution and wisely mimicked it. Wisely, because she saw the intensity of the look on Tiago's face and knew that if she in any way compromised his plans, he would more likely murder her than simply beat her.
"And yet that is exactly what we will do,"
Cassidea whispered in her thoughts in response to her fears.
"Quick to the road," Tiago instructed. "We can intercept him. Astride a great steed that will leap past us or trample us down," Doomwheel said, hustling to keep up.
"He'll do no such thing to an elf of the Moonwood," Tiago said slyly.
But Doomwheel was shaking her head.
"Drizzt knows me and knows my mother well. No doubt he has seen much of her these past months of war, and she will surely have told him of her wayward little doe."
Tiago's eyes narrowed as if he wanted to strike out at her, and she was confident that he certainly did.
"You will intrigue him," he said, a bit too desperately. "Disguise yourself as we go, or tell him that you escaped the clutches of his foul kin. I am sure you could easily offer that lie. Just look into your heart."
The last part had Doomwheel slowing and staring hatefully at her vile companion, to the point where Tiago skidded to a stop and swung around to face her.
"Faster," he demanded.
Doomwheel didn't dare disobey, but Tiago's suggestions rang in her thoughts as a clear warning, and an offering that he knew how much she hated him. Thus, she knew, he was telling her rather clearly that she would not catch him off his guard.
"Patience,"
Cassidea's telepathic voice whispered soothingly. Doomwheel picked up her pace, running hard and closing in on Tiago. As she neared, though, the drow suddenly skidded to a stop again and held up his hand to hold her back. She slowed and stopped and followed Tiago's gaze to the southwest. At first she saw nothing, but Tiago's sniffing tipped her off.
Smoke.
There was a campfire down along the road. They moved more cautiously, Tiago turning directly south to intercept the road. They hadn't quite arrived there when they heard the passage of a horse, of a unicorn. Drizzt had passed them by. Tiago continued, but slowly and cautiously. He held out one hand, fingers working in the silent drow language. A flustered Doomwheel, with only rudimentary knowledge of the hand language, couldn't keep up, but she thought he was indicating that they'd lay in wait and catch the ranger on the way back. A shout, then, from not so far to the west, a chorus of dwarf voices, made Doomwheel doubt that. They were all standing as he neared. Close to 50 dwarves, weapons in hands and all wearing an expression showing that he or she was more than ready to wield a sword or pick or battle axe.
"Far enough,"
one barked. Drizzt held up his hand and backed Andahar a couple short steps. He looked at the group curiously for a few moments, thinking that he recognized more than one.
"Icewind Dale," he said.
"Oh, but it's Drizzt O'Erden,"
said one, a round-bellied, sturdy fellow, Drizzt knew to be Hominy Pestler.
"Aye, a house to Erden,"
another chimed in unfriendly tones.
What?
Drizzt stammered, and he looked from dwarf to dwarf, noting that few expressions had softened with the recognition. Something was wrong. These dwarves were a long way from home, and this was a sizable fraction of the clan settled under Kelvin's cairn in Icewind Dale. And Stokely Silverstream was not among their ranks.
"Why are you here?"
Drizzt asked.
"Might be asking yourself the same question, drow,"
answered another, a yellow-bearded fellow with a long scar down one cheek and a blue eye dulled by the scrape of a blade, now filmy and barely functional. Drizzt knew this one as well.
"I am here with King Brunner, Master Ironbelt," he replied.
He swiveled in his seat and pointed back to the east.
"With Brunner and Emerus Warcrown, and 4,000 shield dwarves. We have fought a war in the Silver Marches against hordes of orcs and giants, drow of my home city, and even a pair of white dragons."
The dwarves seemed taken aback at that remark. Clearly, from their reactions, they had not heard of the war. And so another theory Drizzt held of why they might be this far from home was lost.
"Yourself's been fighting?"
Master Toivio Ironbelt asked.
"For a year," Drizzt replied.
"We heard rumors in Waterdeep."
"Waterdeep?"
"We had ourselves a fight too, Elf,"
Ironbelt said.
"A fight with Drow. Drow saying they come from House Doerden, saying they're your kin."
Drizzt slid off the side of Andahar to the ground and approached the dwarves. "They said the same thing here," he admitted, holding out his hands, far from the hilts of his deadly blades. "If you think me complicit, then take me as your prisoner back to the west to King Brunner."
"We was heading to Mirabar,"
Hominy chimed in,
"to learn what we might of Mithril Hall."
"Brunner is there now, meeting with the Marchion."
Drizzt held his arms out in front of him, crossed at the wrist, inviting a rope if Ironbelt so desired.
"Nah, put him back," the dwarf said. "And well met to ye again, Master Drizzt O'Urden."
"You have a tale to tell," Drizzt said thoughtfully.
"Aye, and not a good one."
"How many of Clan Battlehammer remain in the shadow of Kelvin's Cairn?" Drizzt asked, and he was afraid that he knew the answer. Still, when Ironbelt confirmed that these were the last of the Clan Battlehammer dwarves of Icewind Dale, save a score who had moved to Bryn Shander and a couple of the other towns, Drizzt found it hard to breathe. An era had ended, brutally, he realized, as Ironbelt detailed the Drow raid that had killed so many and taken so many more away into the Underdark.
"We put together a force and followed them,"
Ironbelt explained.
"Oi, and the folk of Ten Towns came out in force to help us. But there weren't no trail."
"They went back to Gontalgrim,"
Hominy added.
"Oi, and dropped the tunnels behind them. And we could no find another way,"
Ironbelt explained.
"We spent a long time trying, don't ye doubt?"
"I do not doubt you at all, of course," Drizzt replied. "And now you've deserted the tunnels beneath Kelvin's Cairn? Seeking Brunner, I would expect."
"Aye, we went to Waterdeep and there spent the winter,"
Ironbelt answered.
"We tried to find another way to get back to Gontalgrim."
"This group alone? You would have been slaughtered to a dwarf."
Some of them bristled at that. "The Drow noble house has entrenched itself in the bowels of Gontalgrim," Drizzt started to explain, but he was cut off by Hominy's remark.
"House Doerden!"
"No. House Orlaren, more grand and powerful by far than anything House Doerden had ever achieved," Drizzt said. "Thick with magic and soldiers, and with many hundreds of goblin and kobold slaves."
"Don't mean we wouldn't try,"
Toivo Ironbelt insisted. "No, of course not. And I would expect no less from Clan Battlehammer. But you'll be trying with better odds, my friend. King Brunner has assembled a mighty force, and Gontalgrim is his goal. Come, I'll take you to your kin, and you can tell your tale to Brunner."
"Curse the gods," muttered Tiago.
He and Doom Wheel on a bluff overlooking the road, where Drizzt had just passed with 50 dwarves in tow on his way back to the army.
"We know their destination now,"
Doomwheel said, for the dwarves had taken up a cheer of Gontalgrim right before they had broken camp.
"You didn't know it all along? Fool. Why would such an army of three kingdoms, all fresh from a difficult war, begin such a march? Could there be any doubt?"
He raised his hand as if to strike her, but Doomwheel shrank away quickly. Tiago turned back to the road and the now distant Drizzt and company. He knew that duty called for him to flee back to Menzo Baranzon and warn the city of the dwarves' march on Cusor Lauren. But he had known that since first he had learned of the army assembled outside of Mithril Hall back in the Silver Marches. It wouldn't matter. The extra 10 days Tiago might offer to the Zorlarans and their allies to prepare paled beside the trophy that now rode away from him down the road. Drizzt was acting as a scout for the dwarves, so it seemed, and so Tiago decided to bide his time to continue to shadow the force. He'd get his chance at Drizzt before they reached Cusor Lauren, he hoped. And if not, he'd find his way inside the complex ahead of the dwarves and kill Drizzt in the tunnels. He glanced back at Doomwheel, His first instinct was to go over and take out his frustrations on her. But Tiago realized that he'd need her if Drizzt was out scouting on that magnificent unicorn he rode. "Patience," Tiago whispered to himself, much the way Casidea had whispered to Dumuil. Brunner, who had experience with a similar Marchion a century before, wasn't much surprised by the cold shoulder offered him in Mirabar. Indeed, on that previous occasion, those dwarves who had left Mirabar to join in Clan Battlehammer's war with the first Obuld had done so as an act of treason against Mirabar, according to then-Marchion Elistal. Nothing that had happened since those days had given Brunner any reason to believe that the atmosphere of rivalry and ambivalence between Mirabar and Mithril Hall would be any bit improved. "Every time a representative of Mithril Hall appears at our gates, it is to ask for help," Marchion Devastal answered when Brunner and King Emerus had explained their march after an exhaustive introductory meeting that contained more niceties and nonsense than anything Brunner had ever imagined possible. "You would have me offer free run to the dwarves of Mirabar to join in with your quest? The cost to Mirabar would be enormous, of course, and you understand that, of course. Are Citadel Felbar, Citadel Adbar, and Mithril Hall offering to pay me to keep my coffers balanced while my loyal subjects are off playing war with an old king, a young whatever you are, and the soldiers of Adbar, whose ruler thinks so much of this expedition that he didn't deign to join it himself?" The advisors around the Marchion, including the city's newest Septrana, all had a good chuckle at the preposterous proposition Devastal had just outlined. Mirabar was a rich city. Her lords and ladies well luxuriated, and in no small part because of their industrious dwarf workforce, nearly 2,000 strong.
"Me kin here in Mirabar are Delzoon," Brunner said. "I'm thinking you're to find a bitter wrath if you're to deny them the chance to march for their ancient home. The warmth of Gontalgrim's in the blood of every dwarf, the hope of finding it's in the dreams of every dwarf. And now I've found it, and so we're to take it back."
"Of course. And you are the reincarnation of King Brunner Battlehammer," the Septrana said with obvious and amused skepticism.
"Aye, and Gontalgrim's a choice for any dwarf that goes deeper than the place he's now calling home," Emerus added, and there was no mistaking the edge that had come into his voice. "I gived up me crown, or are ye doubting me own name as well?"
"Your sanity, perhaps," the Septrana dared to remark, and Ragged Dane bristled at Emerus's side.
"Now I know you, King Emerus, of course," Marchion Devastal said, "though yes, I question the wisdom of your choice. This seems a rather eccentric quest, particularly in this time so soon after war. Wouldn't you agree?"
"What happened before is not to matter," said Emerus. "The road afore us is clear.
You leave your fortresses vulnerable. Orcs are gone and not coming back," Brunner interrupted, his voice reflecting his rising temper.
"The marches are blasted, but sure to mend, and there are enough in all the dwarf homes to hold off anything that's coming.
And two kings, Emerus and Conorad, won't be there to lead if something does come," said the Septrana.
"Two kings replaced," Emerus replied. "And enough of your snickering and thin-veiled insults, good woman. We're marching to Gontalgrim, and we're not needing your permission. We thinked to stop here, that ye might be giving your dwarfs the choice to join in. Sure, and this is a quest that every Delzoon lad or lass should—"
"But you did not empty Felbar or Adbar or Mithril Hall," Marchion Devastal declared, in a bold tone that stopped the conversation short.
"We bringed 4,000,
Emerus replied after a few moments of silence.
"Why four? Why not the 20,000 of Adbar, the 7,000 of Felbar, the 5,000 of Mithril Hall?" Devastal asked.
"Those are the correct numbers, yes? You could have marched past Mirabar with 30,000 dwarves, yet you arrive with 4,000, and you ask me to empty my city of the great value of crafts dwarves? Are the forges of Adbar cool? Are the hammers of Felbar silent? Are the picks silent and untended in the mines of Mithril Hall? Is this a quest for Gontalgrim?
or a ruse to gain economic advantage over a rival city.
Bah! But you really are the descendant of Elistal?
Brunner snorted.
Good to see the line's only gotten stupider.
Several fists banged on the table, and more than one of Devastal's guards edged in closer, and for a few heartbeats it seemed as if a fist fight was about to break out. But then came a calming voice, one that carried more than a bit of magical weight in its timbre.
Even were all the dwarves of Mirabar to join us, the city would remain defended, the mines tended, and the forges hot,
Catibree interjected. What you speak of would be the abandonment of three established cities, something that would be foolish, of course. Adbar, Felbar, and Mithril Hall have responsibilities to the other kingdoms of Lorwar.
The Alliance of Lorwar is in ruins,
the Septrana snidely put in, but Catibree just talked over her.
Sundabar has been reduced to rubble,
but she will be rebuilt with no small help from the dwarves of the Silver Marches, she said.
The orcs are chased away, but no doubt roaming bands will return to the south to cause mischief. And they will be met and defeated by the elves of the Glimmerwood and the dwarves of Delzoon long before they near the work at Sundabar, or the gates of Silvery Moon, or the markets of Nesme.
That last reference brought a bit of a wince to the Marchion, and even to the Septrana, Brunner noticed. For while they could so flippantly insult the dwarven citadels or any of the other kingdoms of the Silver Marches, that little town of Nesme had become a critical trading post for Mirabar. It was quite clever of Catibree to bring the ruined city into the conversation, the dwarf realized.
Yes, Nesme, she continued. The city was flattened by the orcs, with 8 of every 10 citizens killed. But the survivors have vowed to rebuild, and principal among their backers are Silvery Moon and Mithril Hall, even now, even after the march of the dwarves has depleted the numbers in Mithril Hall. It would be wise to help us in those efforts, Marchion of Mirabar. For surely you desire to see the markets of Nesme open soon, even this very season in some manner.
The man had no flippant replies this time, and even nodded slightly.
It is time to stand together for all our sakes, Catibree said.
Yet you run off to the Sword Coast, the Marchion replied.
To Gontalgrim.
Catibree was fast to answer before any of the dwarves could respond.
I've been there. I've seen the forge, and have met the beast that fires it. Know, Marchion, that when Gontalgrim is reclaimed and renewed, the weapons and armor, and all else that flows from the primordial forges, will alter the balance of trade in Faerûn.
All on the Mirabar side of the table stiffened at that prospect, which surely seemed bleak to a city that had made its great wealth through its mining and crafting.
The dwarves left behind in the Silver Marches are as important to the reclamation of Gontalgrim as those marching with Brunner and Emerus, Catibree said. They know it, and we had to hold lotteries to determine which of the volunteers would be granted a place on the march, and which disappointed dwarves would have to remain behind to hold down the homeland in the months or years of transition. Once Gontalgrim is renewed, Mithril Hall, Citadel Felbar, and Citadel Adbar will diminish greatly, will become outposts of the Delzoon mining empire.
Not Adbar,
Brunner thought, but did not say. He was fairly certain that young King Harnoth would not soon swallow enough of his overblown pride, or perhaps it was just his enduring scars and grief, to subjugate his family's accomplished citadel to the greater Delzoon alliance. Felbar and Mithril Hall would indeed become satellite cities of Gontalgrim. Queen Dagnabbit remained a loyal battlehammer above all else. Brunner was quite certain she would surrender the throne of Mithril Hall to him if he insisted, and the dwarves of Citadel Felbar would never think of anyone but Emerus as their true king, so long as the old dwarf drew breath.
Quite a claim, Marchion Devastal retorted. And will the lords of Waterdeep bow to this empire? Will the great armies of Cormyr?
Gontalgrim will be no enemy of Waterdeep, or any of the other civilized kingdoms, and those in power will be glad to have the flow of greater goods in their markets, Catibree said. Will Mirabar?
We have our own, the Marchion started to somewhat timidly reply,
but Catibree clearly had the advantage and wasn't about to relinquish it.
Or will Mirabar now choose to allow her dwarves to partake in the glorious reclamation of Gontalgrim?
Catibree cut him short.
And in so doing, claim her place as a great ally of the fledgling city of the Delzoon Dwarves, a fortress that will become the principal buyer of Mirabar's ore, likely, and one that will offer to the Marchion fine deals on finer goods. For the memories of dwarves are long indeed, and your help now will not be forgotten in the centuries to come.
She let it hang there, and the Marchion said nothing for a long while. Catibree had obviously given Devastol something to think about in an entirely new light. Finally, he announced,
I will take your offer to the Council of Sparkling Stones.
And with that, the meeting adjourned. Brunner and Emerus exchanged knowing smiles, and as they left the chamber side by side, the former King of Felbar whispered in Brunner's ear,
Your girl's deserving a beard.
The group arrived back at the main encampment just before Drizzt rode in at the head of the 50 dwarves of Icewind Dale, who soon recounted their grim tale to Brunner and the others.
That night, 4,050 dwarf voices lifted in unison and carried across the hills and valleys, drifting over Mirabar's high wall with such power that the stones reverberated in the melancholy.
They sang for Stokely Silverstream and the battle-hammered dwarves of Icewind Dale, for the loss of Kelvin's cairn, and for the vengeance they would wreak upon the marauding dark elves. Nearly 2,000 dwarves lived in Mirabar. The next morning, more than half of them marched out of the city's gate to join in the quest for Gontalgrim. Now more than 5,000 strong, all well-armed, well-armored, and seasoned in battle, the army of Delzoon marched to the west, banging shields, clapping flagons, and singing songs of war.